I'm Owen Bennett-Jones, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. Cities such as Denver, Boston, Cincinnati share an unwelcome statistic at the moment: climbing murder rates. And according to some preliminary FBI statistics, violent crime is reaching some unlikely places. The figures show that last year, cities with 10,000 or fewer people saw a 15% increase in violent crimes. Here in Boston, there have already been more homicides in 2004 than last year, and many of the victims are young. Most of those in Boston have been under 24 years old. In a couple of recent cases, a 15-year-old girl and an 11-year-old boy were shot in public parks. The girl was waiting for a pizza. The boy was at football practice. Well, in the next hour, we'll be talking to community activists in Boston, asking them what's behind the violence, who's responsible for stopping it. Do parents and community leaders need to take greater responsibility for what happens in their homes and neighbourhoods? Or does most of the blame rest with the fickle attention spans of politicians and police who ignore the neighbourhoods until the body count starts climbing? The number, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, let me introduce one of our guests in the studio today. It's the Reverend William Dickerson. He's from the Greater Love Tabernacle in Dorchester. Reverend, is it your view that it's really getting worse this summer?
Oh, yes, it's definitely getting worse. I mean, recently I had to bury a father and son at the same time, same day, same funeral. It just lets us know how a lot of people in the community are experiencing the devastation of homicides, and whether it's gang violence or whether it's an isolated incident. This situation really brought home to a lot of people how bad things have gotten, because they were in an area that was supposed to be home turf, or area that was supposed to be very familiar with to them. And to see a father and son, stepfather and son, gunned down at the same time.
Tell us more about that. What happened? Why did it happen?
Well, it was a lot of things that people can say that precipitated it. But the bottom line is that there are a lot of things that are going on in the community that needs to continue to be addressed in a positive way, which there are several people and several groups that are doing that. But in this particular situation, it showed you how angry a person could get in terms of rage, and in terms of dealing with the issues of violence and taking it to their own hands, that not only the father and son were gunned down, but then there was the brother of the father who also was shot, but he survived. And so my whole thing in terms of dealing with that particular situation was trying to let them know that vengeance belongs to God, and that we're not to take vengeance in our own hands. And it was a sad situation, to say the least, but I believe that there were some people that were reached, and that was my job as a clergyman to try to reach those that would receive a message of peace.
So you use your sermons really to hit home that message.
Right, exactly. Some people deal with a eulogy and they just talk mostly about the person who died. I talked a little bit about the people that died. Trucy was there at the funeral as well, but I dealt with the issues at hand. I dealt with the fact that we have a lot of drama in our community that we have to own up to and rectify ourselves.
You just referred there to one of our other guests in the studio, so I better introduce him. It's Trucy Aller. He's a 33-year-old who's got direct experience of gang-related violence. Trucy, perhaps you could tell us a bit about your story. You are in a good position to understand what's going on at the moment. How did you get involved in gang violence?
Well, growing up in the inner city, Boston, first and foremost, I must say that my parents did an excellent job in getting me educated. I went to Cathedral Grammar School prior to going to Catholic Memorial High School in West Roxbury. A situation took place in my junior year at CM relative to sports. And to make a long story short, I was cut from the varsity basketball team. And that was the final straw that broke the camel's back, if you will, which spiraled me into the community.
So you stopped going to school?
Eventually. And what happened was I ended up hanging out in Grove Hall in the Castlegate area. And I began hanging out in the community. Ultimately, it led me to a life of incarceration at the tender age of 19 years old. But while I was incarcerated, it was communicated to me that I was not going to serve time and that the time was going to serve me and that this was a blessing in disguise. And I vowed from that day forward to come back to my community and give back in a way of helping ex-offenders overcome the same problems that I fell into back in my teenage years.
Okay, well, tell us precisely then what you're doing now.
Right now, I'm the Operation Reentry Coordinator for SNAP, which is a part of ABCD, the largest human service agency in New England. And I'm also a faith-based mentor from the Nation of Islam. And I work with ex-offenders every day of my life to help them overcome the same pitfalls that I had to overcome when I was released in 1998.
On the face of it, you're fighting a losing battle. The murder rate is going up. Now, from your knowledge of what's going on, why do you think that is?
Well, there are several problems. One, you have to look at, in 85, the epidemic called crack cocaine was introduced into the inner cities. And we in the inner city have never recovered from that. That's one problem. So I would start systemically saying that we have to do a better job at controlling the drugs and the guns that enter into our community. That's number one. Another problem you could look at is in the DYS system. The sentencing structure guideline is not, it's a farce at best. A 13-year-old can shoot another person and do 6 months and be back on the street. So part of the invincibility, part of the drama that we're seeing today is because a young man will know that the consequences that he or she will face is not going to, it's a slap on the wrist.
Tougher sentences.
That's part of it. That's part of it.
Let me introduce our third guest today. It's Jeanette Boone from the Ella J. Baker House, where she works with Operation Home Front. That's a youth outreach program. Now, I know you've been involved in this for many, many years, and I want to put to you a very striking statistic. In 1990 in Boston, 152 murders. By 1999, that was down to 31, and we're now seeing it going up again. Can you take us through that? What's been happening over that 15-year period?
I believe that the high crime issue helped to bring together clergy, church lay leaders, and law enforcement officials, forming partnerships, working together to quell some of the crime issues. One of the programs that started out of that that very hard time was Operation 2006, which is a weekly meeting that is held at the Ella J. Baker House every Wednesday. It includes all law enforcement, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the DA's Office, local police, churches, and local community-based organizations. And it is a time of sharing the issues of crime in the city and also exchanging information.
What I'm not quite following here, though, is what's changing? Because, Trucy, you just mentioned some long-term factors behind all this, sentencing, drugs and so on. Now, they've been there for some while, for 15 years or so, and yet this year we're seeing an increase. So, Jeanette, what's going on?
Yeah, we've also seen an increase in the number of teens. We're also seeing young men coming back from prisons to the same communities. We're also seeing younger children getting involved in crimes at a younger age than their siblings. And one of the issues, I believe, is that even when these children are taken to DYS and as they're leaving DYS, there is no real aftercare for these children. So they end up going back and forth into DYS.
Reverend Dickerson, do you recognize that picture that people who were arrested and imprisoned in the first wave of violence, if you like, in the early 90s, are now being released, and that explains part of the problem?
Well, that's part of it. Definitely that's part of it, because some of them are back in the game, you know? Our prison system currently is not designed to rehabilitate the young black boys that go into prison, the young men that go into prison. They're just warehouses, and it's warehouses to help employ the white men that have been the ones who have been employed for the longest. And it's really not a system that's designed to rehabilitate these guys. And in fact, when you have people that go into these prisons from various religious groups, they're sometimes harassed because they're trying to reduce the recidivism rate. And meaning some of the correctional facilities, they're trying to keep it up high so they can stay employed. And that's a sad thing.
But you're sitting next to someone who's got a very different story. Trucy says he went.
No, he changed. It was not the prison that changed him. It was the Nation of Islam that reached out to him. Am I correct, Trucy?
Right. That's absolutely correct. And unfortunately, I'm one of the exceptions to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
I should be in a group of majority of brothers coming back to the community with a changed mind and a changed heart. But as Reverend Dickerson just stated, it is difficult to make that 360 change in an institution because the focus is not on rehabilitation. The focus is just, it's on enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Jeanette, that's right.
Jeanette Boone, I'm hearing two different messages here.
Well,
sentences should be longer, and it doesn't work.
I think that they're both correct, and I think that one of the other issues that we have, we do have even churches going in, mm-hmm. mentoring with these young men who are incarcerated. However, when they come out, the aftercare is another issue. There are no jobs, and I can't imagine what people expect when a man comes out, he's got a wife, a family, and children that he needs to support, and he can't get a job because of his quarry.
Do you believe that programs which are known about, you know, existing programs that have been put in place over the last 15 years or so, do actually work to reduce the level of gun-related violence?
Absolutely.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Let me say this. What we just said, Trucy said one thing, I said another thing. Those things are not contradictory. They're factual. For example, there should be stiffer sentences for people that's going to tote guns and shoot people and whatnot. Of course, that would deter people from picking up a gun. You know, I'm not saying that the death penalty, because, you know, that can be very unfair in many ways when we don't know who actually did certain things. But then the rehab part. Trucy could tell you, and I could tell you, because I've been dealing with prison inmates and ex-felons for years, and I know they go in there and they get with people that they were with on the street, and then they began to scheme how I'm not going to get caught when I get out. I'm a more smarter criminal now, because when I get out, based on the quarry laws that stink right now in our state, there should be a revamping of the quarry laws. These guys can't get decent jobs. If they can't get decent jobs, they began to sling drugs again and do whatever they can to support themselves and eventually the children that they have left out there for many years wandering in the streets.
Complicated issues. We're talking this hour about rising crime rates in cities like Boston and Tulsa and elsewhere. We'll be going to some other parts of the United States to find out what's happening and who is responsible for stopping the wave of violence. City leaders, community activists, police, what do you think? And what is the solution? The numbers to call, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Bennett-Jones in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the recent shootings and murders in many of the nation's smaller cities like Boston and Denver. My guests this hour are Trucy Aller, a community activist working with ex-offenders, Jeanette Boone, a youth outreach coordinator with the Ella J. Baker House, and William Dickerson of the Greater Love Tabernacle Church in Dorchester. The number to call if you want to join in on the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Now then, I want to put you this quotation famously made a few days ago by Bill Cosby. I'm talking about these people who cry when their son is standing in an orange suit. Where were you when he was 2? Where were you when he was 12? Where were you when he was 18? And how come you didn't know he had a pistol?
Well, I mean, that is a very startling statement, but it is very factual, very true, that we see that in many situations. These kids that grow up to be gangbangers, it starts somewhere. Sometimes we can see deviant behavior at the age of 5. And when parents are able to intervene, okay, for example, I'm using myself as an example, not say that I'm all that, but I'm a father, and I was a teenage father at that, and I have two adults. I have two adult children, and I've never had to go to the jail or to prison or to court because of their behavior. I made sure, because my father taught me, if you're going to make a baby, you better take care of the baby.
Jeanette Boone, I've been hearing a lot about the prison system being wrong, the rehabilitation methods being wrong. To what extent is it really the families that are wrong?
I if we take a look at basically what's happening in Boston right now, I would dare say that it is the responsibility of all. I mean, you hear the saying that it takes a village. Well, I think that that is very, very true. I think that myself as a community person, I have to step up to the plate when we see issues like this. We've got to send a message to the perpetrators that they can no longer maim and kill and shoot innocent people in the parks. Those mm-hmm. children are in the right place at the right time. And I think we have to send that clear message that we cannot allow ourselves to be hostages to fear. That if you are afraid to give out information, I mean, you have 100 people in a park that see someone get shot and no one comes forward, then they should call the police anonymous tip line, or they should go to a pastor like Reverend Dickerson, give the information and allow him to take that information to the police so that we can solve some of these issues. And I think that sends a very clear message.
Do you ever get that, Reverend Dickerson?
Yeah, I've had to take people in to custody that wanted to go in with me because they were afraid that they might be shot in the back or something like that because of some zealous police officer or whatnot. That happens sometime, and I know that people at this table that have happened with them as well. And so people need that level, even if they have done something wrong. You know, we teach according to the Bible that there is room for reconciliation. And so I think that that's important for us to be there to be able to connect with them if they want to turn themselves in.
Trucy, I don't know whether you can help us with this, but what happens when an 11-year-old child gets killed in a park? What happens in that gang, the people who've done this, the people who know the people who've done this? Mm-hmm. Is there a sense of shame?
There's a sense of shame, personal torment. God doesn't allow those individuals to sleep comfortably until eventually they're caught. That's a situation where the whole community is upset, gang members included. No one appreciates the fact that a woman or a child is hurt by senseless violence. And if you could question the person that's arrested for a situation like that, they would tell you how sorry they are. But the bottom line is, we have to, number one, we talked about a lot of the problem, but again, part of the problem is we have to take it on our shoulders in the community, mm-hmm. you know, and the solution to the problem in the inner city, which is black on black crime predominantly, is the love for self. If I love me, I'm not going to shoot, maim, or sell poison substances to someone who looks like me because I'm looking in the mirror.
That's right.
And I think spiritually speaking, that's the immune system that we need in our community that's going to eradicate the problem that we see. Because police or law enforcement, they will tell you that they cannot arrest their way out of any problem.
Mm-hmm. A sense of self-worth.
Yes.
That's where it starts.
Let's take a call from Stephen in Raleigh, North Carolina. Actually, no, we'll go to Lamont, who's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lamont.
Yes.
What's your point?
Actually, I just wanted to touch briefly on the aspect of rehabilitation in the prison system. I myself was incarcerated for a period of time, and I feel that that system as a whole is not geared towards rehabilitating the individual or getting them back into society. I've been exposed to the Nation of Islam, and as a member of the Nation of Islam, that was the tool or the means in which I was allowed to get back on my feet, come back into society, and be productive.
Well, Lamont, what about the point that it's not all about rehabilitation? Some of it's about punishment.
Right, I understand that as well, but at the same time, the punishment portion is when you get sentenced. Your sentence is your punishment. And while you're there, you're dealing with certain aspects of punishment because you're being society, your family, and things of that nature. So that portion is understood. But at the same time, while they're doing time, they should also have some type of means or way to get when they are to be released, to go out there and be able to be productive. And if there's no avenue for that, you can't expect anything but the cycle to repeat itself.
Lamont, thank you very much for your comment. Let's go now for another perspective. Mayor Bill LaFortune of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, Mayor, you used to be a prosecutor prosecuting gangs who emerged in Tulsa, and you've now moved on to your current position. Tell us, I think you've had some success in Tulsa over the last 12 months, haven't you? What's been going on over the last two or three years there?
Well, to tell you first, I'd like to go back to a comment that was made by one of your panel in terms of 1985 when crack cocaine first arrived on the scene. I was a prosecutor in juvenile court back in the late 1980s when crack really first came to Tulsa. Tulsa is a city of about 400,000 people. The county of Tulsa is about 500,000. We've got about 800,000 in the metro area. So it's a pretty good-sized city. It's the second largest in Oklahoma. But when we saw crack come to Tulsa, and I was right in the middle of it as a juvenile prosecutor because the cases, most of them were being taken to juvenile court rather than adult court, and they were crack, and it was gangs, and it was the first time Tulsa had seen this. And it was kind of interesting. We had a police chief at the time who said that we did not have gang activity in Tulsa, and a lot of us were sitting there saying, wait a second, what else is this? And I think this idea that the inner city and parts of Tulsa certainly are very much like an inner city in terms of other larger cities around the country hasn't necessarily recovered from that initial epidemic of crack cocaine and gun-related activity that comes along with that. So that's the first point I'd like to make. Now, last year, as you said, we've made some great inroads the last 12 months, but we had a bad 2003. We had the highest number of homicides in Tulsa that we've had ever, and close to the numbers we had in the early 1990s.
Let me stop you there and ask, why was 2003, in your view, so bad?
Well, it was because we had accelerated gang activity and a gang war.
Why?
We literally
why?
Had a gang war in Tulsa, and it was mostly African-American on African-American, and it was let me give you an example. Right now, we are 27% lower in terms of our number of homicides at this point in time this year as compared to this point in time last year, because basically what happened was law enforcement, the federal and our local police got together, and they really got the guys who were involved in the gang war, and they locked them up. And it shut down the homicide rate greatly and the gang-related shootings greatly. So law enforcement really did step up and do the job. But I've got to agree with your panelists that it's not just about law enforcement. We've got some great follow-up things we're doing now that I think are going to be very successful, and they're similar to what you all have been discussing. But let me tell you something that's a little different that we did just a week or two ago. The U.S. attorney, with our local district attorney and our local police department and myself and some ministers and some people from our workforce investment group that gets jobs for people, all came together, and we called in certain gang members, people we knew were identified gang members in Tulsa, still out on the streets. Some have been out in prison, now they're back out. But we called them all into a room, and we said, we know who you are, you know, we know what you're doing, and this isn't, you know, this isn't whatever that is, a tough talk in terms of trying to scare you or scared straight. But what we're saying is, you can go to prison for 40 years, because federal time, I'm sure your panelists will agree, federal time for gun-related, drug-related crimes is hard time. I mean, it's hard time, 23 hours a day, lockdown, and it's real time. And as an 18 or 19 or 20-year-old, to go away for 40, 45 years, hard time is a tough, tough sentence, and they're real. In the federal system, at least, they're real. I think.
Yeah, I read about this. It sounded amazing. You really confronted these guys with some very tough talk, from what I could read. How did they respond?
Well, it was interesting just to watch their demeanor. And they started off with a real tough veneer. I mean, and they really act like, you know, I don't appreciate being brought in here. You know, I'm out and I'm free right now. I've already done my time, or I haven't done time yet, and I'm too tough to be in here. Then you all don't need to try to scare me straight. But what happened was, I think the message was, this is where you're headed. You're headed down this road right now to 40, 45-year hard time terms. Or you can make a choice right now, and here are the people in this room to help you. Number one, the faith community. Number two, people who can get you a job and provide you support if you don't have the family support you need and you don't have the community support. We're all here right now not because we're trying to scare you straight, but because we all really want you to make the right choice for yourself and for our community. And to watch their demeanor change over the – it was about a two-hour program. We did one in the morning and one in the afternoon. Had about five or six gang members come in at a time, and they were just surrounded by this group. But I think the message was very clear. You know, we're not here just to scare you. This is just the way it is. This is where you're headed, or you can make a choice, and if you do, we're here to support you with all the resources that you need.
Matt, thanks very much for joining us. And let me just put that to Reverend William Dickerson, because it sounds rather like the approach you're taking from what you said in some of your sermons, taking a pretty tough line and presumably hoping it will have some impact. But to be honest... does it really?
It helps. Some will listen and some will not. And you really reach out to those that will receive the message. Several years ago, we had a transitional home that 80% of the home was funded out of my own pocket. And eventually, after the last person left the program, we folded it because we couldn't get funded. But we found out that was very successful because they were in a positive environment and doing positive things. And although they came from crack cocaine, some of them in the church right now today because of that program. But you have to come right where they are and handle the situation, you know.
I wonder if I just bring in Jeanette Boone and ask you to respond to one of the points made by the mayor there, which was they've had success in the last 12 months. And from what he was saying, it was on the basis of police action, increased police activity. They got in there, they did the job, and they've helped solve the problem.
Yeah.
Is that it? Because, I mean,
well,
everyone just says it should be both.
I believe it's part of it. I mean, I think if you go back to the former years when all of the gang incidents started, that was one of the things that they did. I mean, and we've continued to do that. And Trucy here participates in the what they call the...
The Boston Reentry Initiative,
but they also do ceasefires, and they call gang members and those into a room, and they're given the stick and the carrot. You can either do it this way or you can do it this way. The only thing that we're adding to that now is going to be what we call the Operation Homefront, which will be home visits to those families.
Trucy, you've brokered a ceasefire?
Yes. Well, really? I've been a part of them. But what the ceasefire is you have court-involved DYS youth, gang-involved DYS youth that are put together in one room. And what happens is there are some prosecutors that address them, and then there's some community and faith-based people who also speak to them to give them a different avenue to go up. But I just wanted to make a comment in relationship to what was said from Tulsa, because we do something similar here. Once a month, there's a panel that takes place at the Suffolk County Sheriff's Department, the House of Correction, which is a collaboration between the Boston Police Department and the House of Correction. Now, you have a law enforcement panel, and you also have a faith-based and community-based panel. From the law enforcement side, you have the U.S. Attorney's Office, the District Attorney's Office, probation, parole, the Department of Revenue to help defray the cost of child support, and then you have several faith-based agencies. The law enforcement message is, please, similar to Tulsa, take the hand that's being extended to you from this dream team of support, and everyone that's on the panel is considered to be an impact player according to law enforcement, which is similar to being identified as a gang member.
Let's take a call. Vicky from Virginia. Vicky.
Hi.
Hi. What did you want to say?
We just had this conversation here in Roanoke, Virginia, and on a talk show locally, and someone brought up the point that they had talked to gang members and said, what would it take for you to get out of the gang business? And basically they said, a job that pays $15 an hour. Now, this goes along with a lot of the things that the other people have been saying, including self-esteem and... Of course, there's idle hands are the devil's workshop. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Einstein, I believe it was, said something like, if you keep trying to do the same thing the same way over and over again and expect different results, you're insane. And basically we've been saying, you know, just put them in jail and expect different results, and that's insanity. So I'm saying, why don't we try something different?
Okay, thanks.
What about, say, example, the Youth Conservation Corps that did a beautiful job in rebuilding our parks and building the Blue Ridge Parkway, things like that, put kids to work that didn't have jobs, paid for by the government. I'm sure that the government is spending at least that kind of money, feeding, housing, policing these children.
Okay, Vicky, thanks very much for your point, and I can see a lot of people nodding around the table.
That's a good idea, because now they need to change the name and do not call it House of Correction if they don't expect to correct anything, because it's just warehousing people. So the part of the punishment needs to be correction too, and they need to be able to take care of their babies on the street. And even if they're incarcerated, they need to be able to work in such a way that they can take care of their babies that are back home.
Yeah, but let me just pick up on this point, that Einstein quote. If you're doing something and it doesn't work, don't keep doing it.
Right.
Isn't the point that there was a solution found in the early 90s because the murder rate was very, very high and things were done and it got better? Isn't that it?
Right. It wasn't one solution. There were a number of things that happened in terms of collaborations and people working together, law enforcement, faith-based organizations and community people. And so, yes, we need to go back and revisit some of the things that we may have gotten a little slack with.
That's right. Do you think attention's been lost, Jeanette?
I think so. I mean, I think that there may have been a lull. I mean, we were feeling fairly complacent. And so you drop off doing certain kinds of things. And I think that we find, I mean, even when we go out now and visit kids that we believe are high risk because they're failing in school, and we go and visit with their parents. Many of the parents don't even have a clue of their children being in a gang, number one, nor do they understand that the kids are in trouble even in school. But we try to find mentors and all of those kinds of things for their families.
We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. And if you want to join in, the number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. This hour we're talking about bringing peace to city streets. My guests, Trucy Aller, a community activist working with ex-offenders, Jeanette Boone, a youth outreach coordinator with the Ella J. Baker House, and William Dickerson of the Greater Love Tabernacle Church in Dorchester. The number to call if you want to join in, 1-800-423-8255. Now, Jeanette Boone, I want to pick up on a comment you just made a moment ago saying parents, you go and visit them, you know, high-risk children, ones that you think maybe families who could go wrong, and they don't know what's happening with their children. Is that possible, really?
Oh, I mean, sure.
They must know.
Exactly. I mean, I have visited a number of homes, but one in particular where a young man was having some problems. And as talking with him, we found that he was failing in school. He had been an A and B student. Marks started going down. One of the ministers asked to see his book bag, to look at his room, and the door is covered with gang graffiti. She did not she thought it was art. Did not know he was the son of a minister.
Yeah, but if a child's grades are going down like that, the parents know there's a problem, surely.
Well, but to what extent and why, many times they do not know. And I think that when we come in, we also bring them tips on how to recognize if your child is in a gang.
Reverend, I mean, the reason I'm asking this is because you talk about the importance of community involvement, but are you really talking about professionals, you know, community professionals almost, rather than parents who are part of the community?
Parents and people that are concerned. And most people that live in inner city of Boston. They're concerned, and they are good law-abiding citizens. But what we have to do is extract the fear and let them know that, hey, you need to step forward and reclaim your community, because we have seen it happen in terms of a positive turnaround before, and we can do it again. But we need people that's willing to work with churches and community-based organizations and law enforcement to drive out negativity out of our households and communities.
Is it fair to say that at the moment, these things you say would help are not happening? I mean, if you take these broad daylight killings, nobody's coming forward.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, some of it's out of fear of retaliation. And just during the break, Brother Trucy mentioned about a situation that he was involved in. You want to elaborate on that when they couldn't protect the woman?
Sure. I was working with a mother who lost one of her sons, and I won't say her name, but one of her sons was murdered. Her other son was a witness to the first murder. She made it known to her victim advocate, to law enforcement. I've even met with some of the prosecutors to see if there was a way that we could facilitate an emergency move. This was 2-3 years ago. They couldn't control the federal funds that could make a move like that happen, is what I was told. She resides in the same residence to this day. The second son, who was a key witness, he ended up being murdered.
And you feel that was utterly preventable.
Absolutely. Emergency move. I mean, what does it take to move someone to a hotel even?
Let's take a call. We've got Samuel in Boston. Samuel.
Yes. My problem is we have two sets of problems. One is that the other day I went to a store. There was a 5-year-old kid with a toy gun pointing it at everybody. When that kid grow up, he's just going to make the transition from that toy gun to a real gun and use it to other people. On the other hand, while this is the parents' responsibility, on the other hand, we have the law enforcement that remove the parents' authority from the parents, whereas you cannot educate the kids.
Why do you think that?
What do we do in that situation?
Why do you think that law enforcement removes responsibility from the parents?
Let's say, for instance, if my son do something foolish, I ground him, he call 911, or if I spank him, he call 911, I'm the one that's the villain.
Good point.
So Tracy, what do you say to that, Tracy?
No, that's an excellent point. I mean, to be a real father today, and the children know that they can call 911 and say that I've been abused to get their way. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a real problem. But just, I wanted to add to something that Reverend Dickerson said in terms of ownership. As children, as a community, we have to have respect for authority. And that's what I'm taught. But authority starts with the parent, the teacher, and then law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, but what's bothering me about what you're saying is that if you've got parents whose children's grades are sliding, and maybe they're coming home with expensive clothes, shoes, this sort of thing, they're not going to school. And then the parents aren't delivering in terms of bringing them into line.
That's another equation. When you mention about the expensive clothes and stuff like that, that's totally different. That's a parent who's just ignoring it, and sometimes they're reaping the benefits of it. Right. And there are parents like that. Sure. But when you have parents that are stepping up, want to do the right thing, and they got to worry about being called into question because they're reprimanding their child. I don't believe in physical abuse, but I believe that parents need to take back. If every parent did like our parents did in the 60s and reclaimed their homes, then we wouldn't have many of the problems we have right now in the black community. We're not pointing it all to the system, the systemic evils, the white man did me this wrong and all this whatnot. There are problems that we can rectify right in our own homes, but we have to own up to it and recognize that these are things that are controllable within our own sphere of influence.
Do you think, Jeanette Boone, that's happening? Is it getting better?
I think one of the things that has to happen is that the kinds of programs that we have need to be communicated in a larger way to the community. And hopefully we can use the press, we can use radios to convey that to many of the members of our community. I mean, We sit and talk about the fact, and I mean, I was at a press conference where I called on Black, Latino, and Asian families to come together and to step out in faith. You know, please come and give information on these killings. Someone saw it. I think that parents are afraid, and they are hostages to fear, just as Trucy has said. And I think that we have to do a better job of making families feel safe. I mean, I remember when I worked in Senator John Kerry's office that one of the agencies came to me in regard to the young woman who had been buried alive. Mm. And there were two young men who evidently had some information, and mm-hmm. you could tell they were visibly traumatized. Now, within 3 hours, I was able to find a place for them through the Presbyterian Church, which is connectional. But I found two places, one in New York State and one in New Hampshire. We ended up not using it, but these families would have been able to move somewhere else. And the church was willing to feed them and do whatever they needed to do until they had to go on trial. So,
Reverend.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Back in the 60s, I saw my own eyes in Orchard Park housing development. We used to call it projects back then. Very proud of calling it projects back then. And it was a safe environment. But whenever there was a seemingly upsurge of violence, you know, there were sticks. And somebody, oh, he got a knife. You know, it wasn't the gun thing. You know, my mother, I've seen my mother along with other mothers and a few fathers that would step up and say, no, you're not going to fight. You're not going to do this. You're not going to do that. And they would squash beefs, you know, I mean, just by stepping forward and recognizing that I am a parent in this community and you will respect me, or I'm going to tell your mother. I'm going to tell your father. Nowadays, It's changed, but we saw some things happen even in the 70s and in the early 90s when we saw the Boston Miracle. But what we can't do this time around is rest on our laurels when we see things turning around for the good.
That's my next question, really. Let me put it to you first of all, Trucy. The figures are going up, and it's not just Boston; it's other cities too. Is the country paying attention?
Absolutely. I think so. I think that you've seen the community. I think you've seen the faith-based community more visible and more vigilant. I think we're uniting across denominational lines. I think the effort is there. I do want to go back to the grammar school, middle school, and high school, because if we had a curriculum, educationally speaking, that was a little more suitable or more more proper, we wouldn't have the MCAS problems that we face. If we had a little bit of our history curriculum, then we would aspire to be great. If we know that our people built pyramids, you know, invented the Pythagorean theorem, you know, these are things that I learned when I was in the College of Hard Knocks. Mm-hmm. If that was a part of the curriculum, then we would aspire to be. Charles Drew invented the blood plasma. Now imagine a young African-American young man or woman knowing that of their greatness.
Let me just put this question about the politicians to Jeanette Boone. Do you think, I mean, you know, this is presidential election campaign is on. I've not heard much talk of this issue, yet for the families involved, it is the issue. Do you think the politicians are paying attention?
Well, I don't know whether they are or not. I mean, I think that when you start looking at the whole, the broad spectrum, the national elections, I guess there are a great many things. I do know that John Kerry did announce a program for gangs, and I haven't read all of it about the issue of gangs, but I think that that we are now seeing politicians are coming to us. I mean, I was just at a meeting last week by state legislators. Reverend Dickerson was there, and we presented the kinds of programs that we are doing in the community. That's another way of communicating to the community what kinds of things we're doing, that they can pick up a phone and call us, that we are willing to be there. Right now at the Ella J. Baker, we're doing 7 nights a week of street patrols, just going out talking to young men and young women. We're keeping the Baker House open every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night until 12.
I'm going to try and pin you down now, because over the course of the last 50 minutes, we've talked about police, community, rehabilitation, education, jobs, self-worth, prison, street patrols. I mean, I could probably list a few more things. To try and focus this down, to simplify it, let me start with you, Reverend. What one thing do you believe would improve, most improve, the situation, let's say, here in Boston?
Well, I think nationwide, we are a nation that has forgotten God. And I hate to, I don't want to sound so religious, but it's the truth. And I don't mean just one religious conviction. Mm-hmm. Anybody will tell you, and their understanding of connecting with God, with their source of a higher being, those people who live strong moral lives are able to impact other people's lives. And I'm speaking from a perspective of a Christian, and I once was there, not always doing the right thing. But I'm turned around right now by the grace of God.
Trucy, do you have to be religious to live a moral life?
Well, I agree with Reverend Dickerson 110%. I think spiritually speaking, I vote for God. And I think that's what gives us the immune system to ward off the temptations of the streets, first and foremost. But I can't tell you to stop eating pork and not give you an alternative. We have to provide real resources for people coming back to our community. Otherwise, they're going to go back. They're going to resort back to what they are most comfortable and most familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Jeanette Boone, let me finally just look ahead a little. It's not gone well this year so far. Do you think if we gathered again in 12 months that the situation will have improved?
I think definitely. I mean, one of the things that we're finding is that I think the partnerships are being strengthened. I think that together we will be able to do more visitations of homes of kids who may be at risk. I think that that will be a major help. I think that, as Trucy says, we are stepping across faith lines, and we're willing to take anyone who will come and help us to work toward this. And I'm hoping that we will also begin to see a groundswell from our communities and our neighborhoods, you know, to help.
Well, thank you very much all for joining us. That's we're out of time. It's Jeanette Boone there. And we also heard from Trucy Allo, who's a community activist working with ex-offenders, and the Reverend William Dickerson of the Greater Love Tabernacle Church in Dorchester. And earlier, you may have heard we spoke with Mayor Bill LaFortune of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Connection is produced by Nancy Cohen, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenaloza, Orit Koritsky-Fox, Kelly Jones, Jen Madsen, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. And our senior producer, Tara Murphy. And I'm Owen Bennett-Jones. That was The Connection.